The brick building on Hallam Street in London's Marylebone district appears unremarkable. You only notice at second glance that it is a synagogue. Over a dozen police officers wait along the street, spread out between parked cars. Suddenly, a police motorcycle rushes forward, followed by a wine-red Bentley with a royal standard. King Charles gets out and is led into the synagogue, a discreet appointment away from the public. It is November 9th, 2023. 85 years after the National Socialists set fire to synagogues and thousands of Jewish shops across Germany. The elderly people Charles is about to meet were children back then. In the weeks and months after the Reichspogromnacht, their parents put them on trains bound for England in Berlin, Hamburg, Cologne, Prague or Vienna. A journey all alone into an uncertain future. The children who were able to escape from the Nazis back then are now almost all 90 years or older. Sitting at round tables in the synagogue, they wait for King Charles. When he finally comes, Rabbi Ephraim Mervis greets His Majesty and points out that even now the world is partially broken.
Your Majesty, ladies and gentlemen, at this moment, parts of our world are broken. There is hatred, there is conflict, and there is a tragic war raging in Israel. Our world desperately needs outstanding exemplars of chesed, of loving kindness. And this is exactly what His Majesty the King is. Thank you, Your Majesty, for being here today on the 85th anniversary of Kristallnacht, which inspired the Kinder Transport Initiative. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your contribution towards healing our fractured world.
A small plaque is unveiled that will later commemorate the King's visit. Charles sits down at one of the round tables and begins a conversation with Kurt Marx. He came on a train from Cologne as a 13-year-old and tells the King about a film about himself and his rescued classmates.
The children from Cologne,
yes.
Forgotten and kidnapped from Cologne.
Yes,
but you see, can you remember, were you in Cologne yourself?
Yes.
Can you remember it all?
I had already met Kurt Marx a few weeks earlier for an interview at the German embassy in London. He told me that he came to school on the morning after the so-called Kristallnacht.
We had Kristallnacht, went to school on that morning of Kristallnacht, and when the school seemed to be burning, actually the school wasn't alight, but there was a synagogue next to the school which had been set alight. This started this idea of Kinder Transport. Our headmaster, he decided, or he tried anyway, to bring the whole school to England. If one considers that Kristallnacht was November 1938, in a matter of 2 months, he managed to organize people in England to receive us, also to persuade the parents to let their children go to England. Because in general, people said, no, the children stay at home, we will stay together, we're not going to be parted. But luckily, my parents decided, yes, I could join.
Kurt Marx never saw his parents again. It was only long after the end of the war that he found out that they had been deported from the Rhineland to Minsk and were murdered there. Six days after the pogrom night, an initiative made up of Jewish representatives and Quakers, led by Otto Schiff, the founder of the Jewish Refugee Committee, contacted the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. Their request to provide protection for a limited time to unaccompanied Jewish children up to the age of 17. They would organize the money for the resulting expenses themselves. The children should not be left on the British public's shoulders. Parliament agreed, and on November 25, 1938, Foreign Secretary Lord Stanley Baldwin, in a radio address, encouraged his compatriots to make themselves available as host families.
I ask you to come to the aid of victims not of any catastrophe in the natural world, not of earthquake, nor of flood, nor of famine, but of the explosion of man's inhumanity to man.
On December 1, 1983, the first train left Berlin-Anhalter Bahnhof for London with almost 200 children. After the ferry crossing across the North Sea, they arrived in Harwich a day later, got back on a train, and finally reached Liverpool Street Station in London. Over the next few months, a total of 10,000 mostly Jewish children arrived there. Sculptures still remind us of this today. The transports continued until September 1, 1939. That was the day Germany invaded Poland and the Second World War began. The transports ended abruptly. The last train could no longer leave after the outbreak of war. The historian Tony Kushner researches Jewish migration history at the University of Southampton. It is important to him to emphasize that the Kindertransport was not a government initiative, but rather privately organized. Families who wanted to take in children first had to raise money. £50, the equivalent of more than €3,000 today, had to be paid into a state account as a guarantee, and the families had to pay for the maintenance of the children.
The Kindertransport has, in the last 20, 30 years, developed a special attention, and I think it is because the way it's presented is unchallenging to national mythology, and to some extent the children themselves, or the former children, are happy to be part of that, to express their gratitude. I think it's important with the Kindertransport that this was not a government scheme. It's often represented as such in commemoration, including in the House of Commons itself.
There is a memorial plaque at the British House of Commons commemorating the rescue of the children and thanking Parliament for it.
Today it's going to be bookended with the Kindertransport at one end and the liberation of Belsen at the other, which is a very celebratory account of Britain's record in the 30s and especially in the Second World War. So it sort of can fit national mythologies.
Around 10,000 children were saved by the Kindertransport. A considerable but small number compared to the 1.5 million children who were murdered by the National Socialists in the Holocaust. And many of the rescued children never saw their families again because they were also murdered. Why did the British only allow children to enter the country back then? Was that wrong? The government at that time certainly recognised this dilemma, explains Tony Kushner.
Right from the start in the House of Commons, the Home Secretary, Sir Samuel Hoare, said, you know, it's going to create horrible dilemmas for their parents. So there's another question, you know, why not the adults? And of course, the adults in the government mind pose a sort of different type of threat. They're less sort of, you know, harder to sell in the public sphere. So, you know, the very, very evocative photographs of the children arriving with teddy bears or dolls or whatever at the ports, you know, it's harder to replicate that with an adult male, for example.
And those who agreed to take in children did not always have the best intentions. This is not often discussed publicly either.
The children are treated in a huge variety of ways, and I think that reflects that, you know, unlike today where there is much more safeguarding of children and checking, you know, with refugees that houses and that homes are families are suitable for that sort of fostering of children. Some of those homes were loving and caring and treated the children with enormous respect and awareness of the trauma they experienced, the separation. That's, you know, on one side, and then you've got on the other side people who both exploit the children as a sort of child labour, almost as domestic servants, especially the ones who are a little bit older. Sexual abuse as well, the vulnerability of the children, and those, you know, accounts are not totally rare. And so there was a degree of conversionism as well. And then in the war, some of the older children, particularly the, but not exclusively the male children who are reaching sort of age 18, are part of the general policy of internment, the building that were talking in, which is part of the University of Southampton, was for a couple of weeks an internment camp for the refugees in the neighbourhood, including one or two who were child refugees who had turned 18.
Kurt Marx had described a similar experience to me when we met at the German embassy. He had left school at 15 and had just started his first day at work in a factory when the foreman called him up to the office at lunchtime.
Then he said, "You can't work here. You're an enemy alien. You see, in the morning I was a Jewish refugee. 4 hours later I was an enemy alien," which was quite a shock to me that I should become an enemy alien because there was a war.
In dealing with such aspects of the Kindertransport narrative, the historian Kushner recognizes a phenomenon that he also observes in the dark chapters of British history, such as colonization and slavery. Germany, he notes, has dealt with the persecution and extermination of Jews more intensively than Great Britain has done with anti-Semitism in its own country.
I think the Kindertransport has been written and almost performed as a morality story, where you have the obvious baddie, the Nazis stroke the German people, depending how nuanced you are, how critical should we be? And there is, you know, a sort of, if you like, an official perspective which is more celebratory and a more academic perspective which is more critical.
The Kindertransports always play a central role in the German-British culture of remembrance in the sense of a positive connecting element. During his trip to Germany in March 2023, King Charles visited the Kindertransport Memorial, The Last Farewell, in Hamburg. A month earlier, the German Bundestag's President Bärbel Bas had met some Kinder in London at a monument called The Arrival, as the 19-year-old ladies and gentlemen still call themselves. The monument by artist Frank Meisler at Liverpool Street Station, which shows bronze statues of 5 children with suitcases and teddy bears, was erected in 2006 on the initiative of the then heir to the throne, Charles. Bundestag's President Bas leaned down to wheelchairs and shook hands.
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
This is Ingeborg Hamilton.
Ingeborg Hamilton.
Who was a Kinder.
Hello.
That's right. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure.
Bas thanked Great Britain for taking in around 10,000 miners at the time. A minute of silence was held also for the many children and their families who were killed.
Wenn man aus Deutschland kommt, aus dem Land der Täter.
If you come from Germany, from the country of the perpetrators, it really touches me that I can stand between you today and that we think about these very, very many children together.
Und dass wir gemeinsam an diese ganz, ganz vielen Kinder denken.
The meeting was co-organized by the AJR, the Association of Jewish Refugees. The charity was founded in 1941 by Jewish refugees. It is dedicated to providing social and financial support to Jewish victims of National Socialism living in Great Britain. Chairman Michael Newman described the monument's special significance in broken German.
On dieser Bahnhof ankommt Zug mit Kinder von Europa.
Trains with children arrived at this station from Europe, Germany, Austria. And this monument by Frank Meisler, also a child, an artist, a very important monument for us, for my organization, the Association for Jewish Refugees. It means a lot, your visit to England. We have an opportunity to meet these wonderful children at lunch.
Eine Gelegenheit, diese wunderbare Kinder.
At lunch, the president of the Bundestag chatted with Kurt Marx, among others. And later, in an interview with ARD German Radio, she remembers how he impressed her.
Einer dieser Überlebenden, der 97-jährige Herr, hat mir dann ganz stolz erzählt, dass seine Familie seit über 500 Jahren in Köln gelebt hat.
One of these saved children, a 97-year-old gentleman, proudly told me that his family had lived in Cologne for over 500 years. So they still have this connection to Germany, despite everything that happened, that their parents or their families were murdered by Germans, by the Nazis. That they still look at their old homeland with pride. It's very, very impressive. These stories not only stick around in my mind, but they are important stories. And we always discuss how we maintain a culture of remembrance. So how can we continue to tell these stories when the safe children are no longer with us?
Und wir diskutieren auch immer darüber, wie wir Erinnerungskultur aufrechterhalten. Also wie können wir diese Geschichten weitererzählen, wenn diese Überlebenden nicht mehr da sind?
Even in his old age, Kurt Marx still visits schools and tells his story as a Kindertransport child. He has found that children in Germany know more about the Holocaust than in Britain.
I've spoken to several groups of children in Germany. I found they are very well educated about that period. They know much more than our children here about Holocaust, about what happened.
When the time comes that those affected can no longer tell their stories themselves, the culture of remembrance in the form of books, films or music will become even more important. New York film composer Carl Davis has written a piece for children's choir and orchestra called Last Train to Tomorrow. The composition premiered in 2012. The music in this broadcast is from that work.
It's Aachen. This is Aachen.
This is Essen. We are slowing.
It is the border, the last place, the edge.
Papiere!
Papers!
Dokumente!
Passports!
Passports with a germ, then.
What's this?
Open it!
Öffnen! Hörst du mich?
Are you deaf? Open it!
Was ist das? Suitcases in the middle.
All of you!
Öffnen Sie jetzt!
Open it! Now!
Of course, the story of the Kindertransport can best be told through historical heroes. And such a heroic story is now coming to cinema. In the biographical film One Life, a monument is erected to the British stockbroker Nicholas Winton with Hollywood legend Anthony Hopkins in the leading role. Winton also initiated child transports and thus saved the lives of 669 children from Czechoslovakia. With helpers in Prague and great persistence, he overcame numerous administrative hurdles in Great Britain to organize a total of 8 successful train journeys to London. When he was asked in a BBC interview shortly before his death what motivated him, he replied,
"Ethics. Goodness, kindness, love, honesty, decency. Ethics. That's standard of life. I believe in ethics. And if everybody believed in ethics, we'd have no problems at all."
The story of Nicholas Winton only became publicly known in 1988 through the BBC television programme That's Life. The then 78-year-old Winton was invited onto the show and was surprised to find Vera Diamond from his recently discovered list of rescued children. TV presenter Esther Ranson explains she's sitting right next to you.
This is Vera Diamond, now Vera Gissing. We did find her name on his list. Vera Gissing is with us here tonight. Hello, Vera. And I should tell you that you are actually sitting next to Nicholas Winton.
A hug, and Winton touched, dabs his eyes with a handkerchief. After this broadcast, more rescued people came forward, and the moment when Winton was invited to the studio a second time went down in British television history.
Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please?
The entire audience stood up.
On behalf of all of them, thank you very much indeed.
In the years that followed, Winton maintained regular contact with those he rescued and their families. He received countless awards and honors, also for his continued charitable work. Nicholas Winton died in 2015 at the age of 106. According to Winton's daughter, who wrote a book about him, at the time of his death, 7,000 people survived or were born because of his rescue operations. Historian Tony Kushner thinks it's comprehensible to make Winton the hero of the rescue story, even if that is only part of the truth.
You need to sort of create a narrative pattern which has got someone who is the hero figure. And I think people like Trevor Chadwick, who, you know, has remained rather obscure in the story, whereas Winton was, you know, sort of fitted the role of a very kind, gentle soul, and which he was, a very decent man, and was doing the hard paperwork at home, it was Chadwick, who was a sort of rogue before and then a rogue afterwards, a lovable rogue mainly, though you know, not without his major faults, has been ignored in that story. And in the case of Winton, even though he's got part Jewish roots, he sort of fills that figure. And after a while, there was almost ran out of awards that he can give him. He didn't want the attention, I think it's fair to say. He really was surprised by it. Whilst everyone else was sort of indifferent, he was the person we can grab hold of and say, look, this is what should have happened, and he did it, and we should honour, which you know, was the case.
Winton's friend and helper, Trevor Chadwick, apparently struggled with alcohol problems throughout his life and led an unstable life. That doesn't fit well into a story of noble saviours. Chadwick died of a stroke in 1979 without his dangerous work on the Kindertransport ever being recognised. A memorial to him was recently erected on a playground in his hometown in Dorset. The film adaptation of Winton's story, One Life, had its European premiere at the London Film Festival in autumn 2023. In the Talmud, the Jewish interpretation of scripture, it says, if you save one life, you save the whole world. One small act can set in motion an avalanche of good deeds, Winton's granddaughter Holly Watson explained on the red carpet.
Every small action can help. Every small action can help snowball into a bigger action. Every one life is just as important. Save one life, save the world. That's why the film is called One Life.
A dramatic scene in the film revolves around the fact that there are delays in issue and entry papers for the planned 9th train because the responsible official in the ministry is on vacation. His colleagues mockingly shout to the desperate Winton that he will just have to be patient for 2 weeks. The largest transport with 250 children could not leave until September 1, 1939. But that day the war began with the attack on Poland. The train is prevented from leaving Prague. Most of the children on this train do not survive the war. 250 foster families in London wait in vain. If the train had left just a day earlier, the escape would have been successful. His father never forgave himself for that, said son Nick Winton.
I mean, Pa was always sad when he talked about this, because the last train that he organised of 250 children never left, because that was the day that Hitler marched in. And he always, I think, reflects on what he didn't manage to do rather than what he did manage to do. So it's a little bittersweet.
The bureaucratic delay, the lack of an official stamp that torpedoed the courageous work of the activists and the saving of children's lives, the screenwriters consciously give space for this in their film. The British state, which today likes to be celebrated as the enabler of child transport, is seen as the hinderer. Screenwriter Nick Drake.
I think it is true. They would have saved many more children if the process of bureaucracy had been more amenable and more efficient. And that is a somber thought.
From the perspective of screenwriter Lucinda Coxon, not much has changed to this day.
I mean, as today, there are many, you know, there are many different responses to that question. There are many people who are working very hard to try and help refugees. There are people who are trying to just grapple with the reality of how you might best do that. And there are people who, for their own reasons, are hostile to the idea. It's not really changed.
Someone who really wants to change this is also walking along the red carpet. Lord Alfred Dubs. The 90-year-old arrived as a 6-year-old on one of the trains from Prague organized by Winton. Dubs was lucky. His mother also managed to escape to England a short time later. He grew up in Manchester. After completing his studies, he initially pursued a career in administration and was then elected to the House of Commons for the Labour Party. In 1994, he was made a life peer, which means elevated to the peerage for life, and has since then sat as a lord for the Labour Party in the House of Lords.
It's a great honour for somebody who arrived at Liverpool Station at the age of 6 in 1939 to suddenly be here and to be commemorating a person who did something so important and saved a lot of our lives. I think that's a great privilege, And it's wonderful the films we made about him, because he was a very special person. And he didn't just say, there's a problem, oh dear, and walk away. He said, there's a problem, and I'm going to do something about it. And that's what distinguished him from other people.
But Dubs also feels depressed due to the current world situation. At the film premiere, it was just a week ago that Hamas terrorists from the Gaza Strip attacked Israel and brutally murdered there.
If the film is going to have any impact, it teaches something as to how we should behave better in the future. And it's tragic what's happening now. I can hardly watch the news. It's just so personally painful.
A few days later, I meet Lord Dubs in his small office in Westminster. He has used his position as a politician in recent decades to campaign especially for underage refugees. In 2016, a change to the law known as the Dubs Bill was passed. It should ensure that Great Britain should accept unaccompanied minors, for example, from the camps in northern France. But when the law was passed in the House of Commons after a long struggle, the Conservative government outsmarted him, Dubs describes.
They said, okay, they accepted the amendment, and then they did a dirty thing. They said, we're going to limit it to a certain number, which is ridiculous. We never talked about that, 480.
Lord Dubs also ultimately failed with another initiative.
The effect of it would be that Britain had to negotiate to continue the terms of the Dublin Treaty even after we left the EU. And that passed the Lords, and the government eventually accepted it in the Commons. That became part of the 2017 Immigration Act, or whatever it was called. And then in 2019 they took it out. And I was absolutely furious.
In 2022, around 45,000 people came to England by boat across the English Channel. Compared to other European countries, this appears to be a manageable number. But the measures taken by the Conservative British government are aimed at harsh deterrence. Former Home Secretary Suella Braverman spoke at the last party conference of an expected hurricane of refugees. The government has negotiated a deal with Rwanda to deport refugees who enter illegally to the African country without examination, even if courts have so far prevented this from actually being implemented.
I think it is despicable. I'm lost for words. I don't want to use language you'd have to translate into German, which would not be very good. I think it was shocking, it was despicable, it was cheap, it was nasty politics. It let Britain down. It let the refugees down. The most recent legislation says that if they come by an illegal means, defined by the government as if they come on a boat, that's not legal, and therefore they're not allowed to claim asylum. And that is something which is a breach of the 1951 Geneva Convention.
But despite all the anger aimed at the current British government because of what Dubs sees as an intolerable course of refugee policy, the politician defends the United Kingdom when it comes to the Kinder transport of 1938-39. He does not accept criticism that more could have been done and, for example, also adults should have been accepted.
I think the debates in Parliament were quite tough in 1938. I've read them. And some people didn't like the idea, but on the whole, there was sympathy. And so Parliament played a part in enabling it to happen. Yes. Yeah, it would have been, in an ideal world, it would have been great. But that was not an ideal world.
Incidentally, even Nicholas Winton still didn't think the world was ideal shortly before his death in 2015. In a BBC television documentary, he explained in the face of wars, refugees, environmental destruction and social division.
I think the world's gone absolutely balmy. We've gone through 100 years of the greatest achievement that man's ever made. Technically and in many other ways, and look at a mess we're in. Nothing much to be proud of, is there? We've left the place in a more dangerous situation than it's ever been.
And his granddaughter, Holly Watson, is convinced that the British government's current refugee policy would make her grandfather angry.
Now we would understand that he thought that it was inadequate, which I think is definitely the case. His work before the Second World War was a far bigger step than we've taken since then. And look how much he's lauded now for the work that he did then. And look at the situation now. If we think that what he did then was such an amazing thing, how does that draw parallels with what's happening now? I think that's pretty clear.